The CEC's Fossil Free by 33 program is a model that I hope will shape our national energy policy. The Community Environmental Council has been a catalyst for positive change for a generation. I have no doubt that their vision and innovation will help us find a better and healthier way with energy.
This is Peak Moment. We are living at a peak of human innovation, information, wealth, and health. But we're also at a peak of population and consumption, with rising temperatures and declining resources fueled by cheap oil and gas. Peak Moment Television, bringing you examples of positive responses to energy decline and climate change through local community action.
Hi, welcome to Peak Moment. I'm Janaea Donaldson. Here in the city of Santa Barbara, there's an organization looking very far forward to being fossil fuel free by 2033. I'm here with the program manager, Tam Hunt. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
So what is this program and what is this organization? Seems pretty gutsy.
Yeah, well, definitely. It's very ambitious, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. Just some history very quickly. The Community Environmental Council, the CEC as we call it, been around for about 36 years.
Wow.
It was, in fact, inspired by the now infamous oil spill off Santa Barbara.
Yes.
And as your other interviewee mentioned, that Santa Barbara is, in fact, you know, one of the birthplaces of the modern environmental movement, and that is a big reason why, as we had this major oil spill here, that prompted organizations like us to come into being. And so we kind of gained our name in recycling and organic gardening and other programs and education. And then about 4 years ago, our board sat down and had a, you know, a long heart-to-heart session as to what they really should be focusing on, and it was the general opinion that it was time for a major shakeup in our mission. We'd gone from being kind of a catalyst, a visionary organization, to being more of a service organization.
Ah.
And this often happens with nonprofits that have been around for a while, and that they lose some of their edge that they had when they first began and become a bit too mainstream sometimes. Definitely, you want to be mainstream to actually affect the mainstream society. At the same time, though, you want to be a catalyst, which requires you go a bit beyond sometimes.
So you go past your comfort zone and, you know, at the edge of what's most needed now, I would imagine.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. All right.
And so there was a full-day retreat with our board, and they kind of sat down and said, all right, what are the major issues facing us today? And after a long process, they realized that, look, all these issues we see as being the major environmental problems today and on the horizon can be traced back to fossil fuels. And this is no revelation today, but a few years ago it was.
That, you know, several years ago, they were ahead of most people.
They were, yeah. And so they kind of took this, internalized it, and said, okay, well, we're going to create a new program. And we're going to be visionary again. And they created the program we call now Fossil Free by 33 for shorthand.
Fossil Free, okay.
Yeah, Fossil Free by 33. And so weaning our region, which is the Tri-County, Santa Barbara County, Ventura County, and San Luis County, off fossil fuels by 2033.
Now, you want to have three counties not using, and everybody in them, not using fossil fuel free, fossil fuels.
That's the plan. Yeah, and so very ambitious.
Wow.
Some would call it kind of crazy. And, you know, I mean, it's doable. We're looking now 27 years ahead.
Yes.
When they began the program, it was 29 years ahead. And, you know, it sounds like a long time, but when you're talking about major infrastructure changes, that's really not that long. And so in terms of, you know, reality on the ground, we've got a lot of work to do. It's going to take a lot of cooperative efforts throughout society, top down, bottom up, basically everyone pulling. And, of course, since we began the program 2 years ago, we were leading the message. We were trying to get the message out there on climate change and peak oil, because even though they were known, they were not major issues in people's minds.
Yeah,
of course, in the last year, the climate change issue has very much changed, and now we're kind of chasing the message in terms of the message is out there. People know this is a major problem,
yes,
the large majority of people. And so now it's up to us to use what has now become a commonly accepted problem, which is a real problem, of course, and suggest our solutions as the right solutions. And this actually becomes more problematic when you talk about peak oil. With climate change, the solutions, you know, there are varied solutions, but they all come back to using less energy.
Yes.
Using energy more efficiently.
Yes.
Using renewable energy.
Right.
When we come to peak
Don't
oil.
Don't cut your forests down.
Exactly.
Which may not be an issue in your communities, but that's going to be part of it.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, all these wide array of issues.
Alrighty.
With a peak oil paradigm is a little different, because a lot of folks who will learn about peak oil and become concerned about peak oil can come to widely divergent solutions. And you have, of course, right now in the U.S. and around the world, a new renaissance for nuclear power.
Yes.
Because of its alleged climate change benefits,
yes,
having fewer greenhouse gases than other sources.
Right.
We don't support nuclear power, and that's probably beyond today's conversation.
I am heartened to hear that, because it has enough raft of other problems that are and dangers.
Exactly.
And potential uses for warfare that
exactly
we don't need to have to deal with that as well.
Exactly. And also, on in terms of climate change, people talk about nuclear power as having no climate change emissions, GHG emissions, and that's patently not true. Of course, if you look at the life cycle, which you have to for any of these emission sources, there are significant emissions. It's still lower than fossil fuels, but to talk about it as being a zero emission source is simply not true.
Right.
Yeah. And so, just to finish this thought,
the peak oil,
the peak oil framework leads to many different solutions, uranium, nuclear power being one of them,
right,
drilling more being another,
mm-hmm,
coal power being another.
Yes.
And so this is where, for us in our program, I talk about climate change and peak oil as being the twin crises facing us.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to have both concerns in mind when proposing solutions, because if you have the peak oil framework in mind and you realize that we need to rapidly transition away from peak oil, but then you also realize that climate change is an equally pressing problem, maybe a little different time horizon. I think probably for major problems to occur, probably be a bit later than peak oil. But, of course, we cannot simply go down the road and say, let's do more coal, let's drill for more oil, because then you're simply exacerbating another major crisis.
Exactly.
Climate change crisis. So you need to have
that,
both paradigms in mind when proposing solutions.
Right.
And so that's one thing that we really do see ourselves being useful in, is kind of going through this obstacle course of different solutions and helping folks who are looking to do the same thing and say, look, we've done this analysis, we found this and this and this, and here are our solutions for our region. And, of course, it requires a different analysis for each region. But by having a template, we can export as a replicable model.
So that other communities can do the same,
exactly,
same kind of thing.
Exactly.
So give us, I mean, I'm dying to know, what kinds of solutions are you know, obviously, you can only give me the top of the highlights here of solutions for your three counties here, which are both rural counties with cities in them. We're not talking, so you've got both urban and suburban and rural populations.
Yeah, definitely. We're not a major industrial area. We don't have much industry. We have, Santa Barbara County is on the south coast, a tourist-oriented economy.
Right.
Everyone knows that. It's beautiful here.
Yes, it is.
80 degrees outside today in November. North County is more rural, more agricultural,
mm-hmm,
and this actually reflects the division in California itself, in that you have, you know, more tourist, more high-tech oriented communities on the coast, and then you have more agricultural, rural inland in California itself. So it's an interesting microcosm of California, and you could say the same thing for the whole country. So we have, you know, many different levels here we can look at. So in terms of like our general strategy for getting off fossil fuels and mitigating climate change, I use the phrase, you know, at my own peril, is electricity stupid?
Because it's the electricity stupid.
It's really
kind
of...
Do you have buttons to say it's the electricity stupid?
We should. We should get those, definitely. But the basic idea is that, you know, first of all, you need to use less. And that should be understood in every solution we're looking at. Conservation, energy efficiency is the first step. It's the most cost-effective. It's the quickest to implement, and it makes the most impact. The second step for us is actually getting large amounts of new renewable energy on the ground.
Electricity. Okay.
This is the first step. And so I'll talk more about biofuels in a second. But in terms of electricity, again, is electricity stupid? Is the general tagline for this idea that we need more renewable electricity to get off fossil fuel electricity and eventually nuclear-powered electricity, which we have in California.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we need large amounts of additional renewable electricity to electrify the transportation sector.
Okay, so I'm just clarifying. More electricity that's renewable, so we can retire our fossil fuel-burning plants that give us electricity, and an additional capacity in electricity to be able to fuel or power vehicles.
Exactly. And so this requires, of course, another step that we don't have yet, and that is cars that run on electricity.
Yep.
And so the reason we talk about electricity and electrifying the transportation sector is that the main solutions we see out there as being the most promising, going beyond hybrid cars and more efficient cars, which, of course, again, these are hybrid cars are a way of more efficiently using petroleum.
Yes, indeed.
So, again, this goes back to the first
step. They're transitional.
More efficient. Yeah, more efficient use.
But not perfect. I mean, not clean.
Far from perfect. Far from perfect. I have a Prius. It gets 45 miles per gallon. It's great, but it's still 1 gallon for each 45 miles I go. And so in terms of more perfect solutions, better solutions, we see plug-in hybrids, mm-hmm. electric vehicles, and possibly even hydrogen fuel cell vehicles as being a large part of the solution. And my personal preference will be plug-in hybrids because they have the best of all worlds. You have basically an electric battery, which you can charge from the grid or from a gasoline, giving you basically a 30-mile range, ideally, on electricity only. And it's going to depend on technology as to how far the range actually is. And then you have the other side of the coin, you have increased range if you need it from gasoline or better yet, ethanol or biodiesel.
Mm-hmm.
And so you
mm-hmm.
could, in fact, have mm-hmm. a very clean solution with a plug-in hybrid that can run on biofuels. Electric vehicles could also be a major part of the solution if the battery costs
right.
come down sufficiently.
Right.
And we have cars right now being produced this year, not yet, but this year, allegedly, by Tesla, the Tesla Roadster.
Right.
$100,000 sports car, very sexy little car,
right.
still way out of the price range for most people,
of course.
But a lot cheaper than $1 million per prototype for fuel cell vehicles. And so
yeah.
hopefully that will come down in cost to, say, $50,000 in a few years. That's starting to get into the range where we can actually see a pretty wide impact. Then we get to $25,000, you know,
right.
and we're talking a mainstream car.
And particularly if we can improve our battery technologies, which
key.
Is part of the key for electric vehicles, and
yep.
then we have them a lot cleaner.
Exactly. And then the third thing I mentioned is hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. And this, of course, has been talked about a long time. It's supported by the governor of California.
Right.
It's supported by the federal government. And there's been a lot of debate in the recent years about, is this a good way to go? And frankly, you know, I said it a minute ago that my preference is plug-in hybrids, or better yet, EVs that have good range
electric
and that
fuels,
are
yeah.
affordable. But I recognize that hydrogen fuel cell vehicles may be on the road in the next 5 to 10 years, and companies are saying that will be the case. If that's the case, we need to have a green hydrogen future
uh-huh.
where we produce hydrogen from water by using renewable electricity to electrolyze the water.
And I was going to get you there because right now my understanding is that most of the water that's being used to create hydrogen is coming from fossil fuels to be able to split.
They use natural gas nowadays.
Natural gas.
Yeah, the steam reformation of natural gas. Yeah.
Be, you know, it's a fossil fuel.
Exactly. And so it's an improvement, even if you use natural gas, because
yes.
natural gas is the cleanest burning fossil fuel, but it's still a fossil fuel.
Right.
It's finite and it still pollutes.
Right.
And it's not clean natural gas. It's simply a marketing slogan. And so to wrap up the point, in terms of the is electricity stupid paradigm, you have three major possible solutions here in terms of future technologies: electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids, and hydrogen fuel cell
mm-hmm,
cars.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Each one of those requires large amounts of new electricity. And so whichever way we go in terms of these different technology development
yeah.
you know, lines, we need more electricity.
Okay.
And that's a good thing in general. Under either any of these future pathways, it's a large improvement because electricity is a much more efficient means of moving things around. It's innately more efficient. If you have an electric motor versus a gasoline engine, the electric motor is innately more efficient in terms of actually capturing
really?
More of the power that goes into it.
Yeah, uh-huh.
A lot of energy is wasted with gasoline
with
vehicles, internal combustion
yeah.
engines.
Right.
Yeah, they're not very efficient. They can be more efficient, but they will never actually reach the level of efficiency of an electric motor.
Okay.
And so that's kind of the general framework, again, for the electricity needs in the future. And then if you at the same time develop biofuels to the degree that it does not impinge on food needs and food security, then you can, you know, under the plug-in hybrid model, use those biofuels
yes.
for additional needs beyond the batteries. Or you can use biofuels in other vehicles. Particularly biodiesel is very promising because diesel engines are also innately more efficient than
yes.
gasoline
yes.
engines.
Yes.
And so We're not advocating switching out the gasoline-powered fleet for diesel cars, but certainly if we do go down that road in terms of national policy and trying to direct how manufacturers produce cars as a midterm measure, simply selling more diesel-powered cars separate from biodiesel would be a major improvement.
Sure, you've got diesel efficiencies and then they're biodieselable.
Exactly.
You know. The question I would ask is about ethanol in here, where it might fit into the picture, because it would seem to me that ethanol, which can indeed be produced from woody wastes, and we all have to trim our forests, and there's also some forms of material that aren't going to cut into our agriculture, because that is a big concern on my part, is if we all decide to swap out all of our diesel vehicles for biodiesel, it would take more land than we have cropland in America, which means we don't eat. I mean, it's not a viable solution
here.
I'd rather
get in my car, definitely.
Yes, yeah. Right. Yeah. Or only the wealthy get to drive and the poor don't get to eat. I mean, the social justice issue that shows up here. So where might ethanol fit into the picture? I'm not studied in that.
Well, ethanol right now comes from corn in the U.S. primarily. Not entirely, but primarily.
Okay.
Biodiesel comes primarily from soy. And so both of these have problems in that they require fossil fuels to produce.
Yes.
So when you hear talk about the energy balance of biofuels, ethanol and biodiesel, it's because you're using fossil fuels to create them. And
right.
So if you're using more fossil fuels than you get out in terms of usable energy, then why are you doing it?
For sure.
It's a net loss.
For sure.
The best scholarship, though, actually has found that there is a net increase in energy. So it is a net positive energy balance, again, depending on how much fossil fuel you use to actually produce it.
To produce your crops, yes.
Exactly. But then the second issue, which probably is more important, because, again, it's my belief, and many studies have supported this, that show there is a positive energy balance from ethanol, even from corn. The other issue is that you are, of course, using a food crop to produce energy.
Right.
And so right now in the U.S., we use about 15% of our corn for ethanol. And so as ethanol ramps up in production, and it is at a very fast pace in the U.S., then you're using more and more of that crop for fuels instead of food. And right now, here's another phrase you may not have heard, peak grain is being talked about more and more.
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
Peak grain.
Peak grain in terms of basically,
you know, reaching our limits of what we can...
Maybe not so much the limits of what we could actually produce, but the limits of what we have produced and the limits of what we may in reality produce.
Well, now we're looking at, grain and soy, all and corn, all have a huge amount of fossil fuels in their production, right?
Exactly.
The pesticides and the natural gas is used for the fertilizer and tractors. And, I mean, it's got a very large fossil fuel usage. So when we look at going to ethanol or biodiesel, we're also looking at having to shift the production fuels, aren't we?
Definitely.
Also?
Yep. For the next 10, 20 years even, depending on when peak oil arrives, and we don't know at this point, it's going to be harder and harder to use those fossil fuels to produce biofuels, especially if you can't get more efficient and make the energy balance more productive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the way we frame this, you know, we do support biofuels, but we say this is the first step to building an infrastructure that we like, but the next step is to change the feedstock. And so on the ethanol side, you need to start producing it from things like switchgrass or poplar trees or willow trees or straw, cellulosic forms of ethanol, because those are much more efficient and don't require prime ag land to produce.
Okay.
Require less water. Some of them can actually build soils. So a lot of benefits there while actually producing a usable fuel.
Okay.
On the biodiesel side, same kind of argument. Right now we get it primarily from soy, but things like Jatropha, an Indian plant being cultivated right here in Santa Barbara for use as a fuel crop, has very high oil yield and at the same time doesn't require prime ag land, requires less water, and can build soil.
Oh, well, so we're getting net gain in several directions.
Exactly, yeah. Uh-huh. And so, you know, we don't see biofuels as being a large source of energy for our society, even here in the Tri-Counties, and even if we do achieve our goals of being fossil-free, we see them being significant. And when I say significant, I mean probably 10 to 15% of total energy use. But we're not talking half of our petroleum fleet being fueled by biofuels. And this is largely because of, you know, the limits we talked about already in terms of, you know, available land, feedstock issues, food crop issues, but also because, you know, I'm fairly optimistic that we will, in fact, have the EVs or the PHEVs or the fuel cell vehicles on the road in large numbers in the next 10 to 15 years. And so we'll see definitely more biofuels being used in the next 5 years, because right now that's
kind of
the primary,
if you will,
option. You know, it's really the only one on the ground today other than conservation that can have a large-scale effect. And so in the U.S. today, we have about 4 billion gallons a year of ethanol production. That's about 3% of total production in the U.S., and it's growing very fast, so it'll probably be up to, like, you know, 4 or 5% in the U.S. by the end of next year, say. So significant but not huge. In California, we still have only one ethanol pump in the whole state. 37 million people, one pump. So not a whole lot of ethanol being used in California.
Wow.
And so we're actually, one thing we're doing is we're promoting ethanol plants. We secured a grant for local station owners to help them defray the cost of ethanol pumps locally, so we can actually sell it. Even if it's not the ideal feedstock, we want to, again, build the infrastructure so we can transform it into the ideal feedstock.
Have their vehicles converted so they can use the ethanol and so on.
Exactly.
You know, a little computer chip that's needed to switch to that.
And actually, in California, there are a lot of vehicles that can run on ethanol. Flex fuel vehicles is about 400,000 on the road in California, but people don't use them for ethanol
because you can't get the ethanol. Here we are, the infrastructure.
Yeah.
So in your plan, you just made me think of two things. One is the big trucks, which is diesel, which I'm sure you're thinking then is biodiesel as a transitional fuel for the big vehicles. What about buildings? What about, is that in your picture at all?
No, definitely, I mean, we're trying to be as comprehensive as possible. And so it's taking a long time for us to put out our blueprint, which is our big policy document, but we're going to finish that probably January timeframe now. It's a two-year effort. And in that document, we look at electricity use, natural gas use, and petroleum use. That's all our energy, the whole shebang. And so our goal is to basically eliminate fossil fuels from each of those three major sectors. Another way of looking at energy use, of course, is by buildings, transportation, so on and so forth. And so in terms of buildings, Doss Williams, who was here before me, mentioned that the city is, in fact, looking right now at implementing its own vision for its buildings under the 2030 challenge proposed by Ed Masria. He's a nationally known architect who has basically put out a challenge to architects around the country to reduce building energy use by 60% by 2010 and then being carbon neutral by 2030.
Yes, so, just in time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's still a ways out there, but I mean, it's an incredibly ambitious goal. I mean, what we're up against here is, you know, fundamentally contrary to the way societies have behaved for the last two or three millennia. You know, we're basically saying you should stop using energy to the degree you are, or, I mean, I should frame it differently. We're saying you should use different types of energy, but fundamentally you should use less energy.
There, and that's very contrary to what humans have been doing.
It's very contrary, and it's very difficult. And so in terms of climate change emissions and the numbers, I was just reading today that the U.S. has actually increased its climate emissions 16% since 1990. That's a big problem because, of course, the Kyoto Protocol, which is considered just a modest first step to reducing emissions on a global basis, calls for a 5% reduction below 1990 emissions by 2012. So when the U.S., the biggest emitter in the world, has gone up 16% since 1990, it should have gone down 5% from 1990 by 2012.
There's a huge gap here.
And so again, on the building issue, we are working with local architects and the city of Santa Barbara and the county of Santa Barbara to draft a plan for achieving a 2030 challenge. And it's going to focus initially on city and county buildings, but then it will spread to residents in those
jurisdictions. And you're starting with new buildings.
It will start with new buildings and then over time, it will expand to existing buildings.
Retrofit existing buildings.
Exactly. Yeah, and so it's difficult. I mean, the problem here, well, there are many problems here, but one of the bigger problems is that these measures we're talking about on the building side to improve efficiency and reduce energy use are often going to cost a bit more up front. You know, they don't have to. They can cost less. And, in fact, passive solar design especially yes. here in Santa Barbara, can save a lot of money right. Just simply by reorienting a building. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But other measures are going to cost a bit more. But people need to understand they're going to save you operating costs over time.
And so there's an education job here.
There's an education job. And there's an accounting system yes. change that's required to yes. allow people, governments or homeowners or businesses, to capture those operating cost savings and include that in your analysis up front.
Of course.
Maybe figure out how to get a bit more money up front for capital to build what you need to build, understanding you'll save money over time. And so there's a lot of education.
And a different economic model.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. In our last minute. Our last minute. Any last bits of wisdom here? Anything we haven't covered?
I think one thing that should be stressed in working with all groups in this area in terms of combating climate change and dealing with peak oil is that, you know, it requires, again, a full spectrum approach, top down, bottom up. In terms of working with governments, which is definitely a big part of this, and, you know, a lot of my time is spent essentially lobbying local governments. I'm an environmental lobbyist with my hat on. And I often run into the problem of local governments saying the right things but not following through. And I want to plug City of Santa Barbara very quickly here because they've done some great things here and they are continuing to evolve. And we hope that City of Santa Barbara will be a great model for others to follow.
Yes.
That said, we need to ensure that all local governments impose on themselves, if necessary, mandatory enforceable goals.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
in the era of climate change, it's all about quantifying things.
Yes.
Because if you have a few model programs but no overarching vision and numbers to back this up,
yeah.
it's meaningless.
Right.
You need to have the whole picture in mind. And that's why this is such a difficult problem, because it's not simply about symbolism. It's about real action
yeah.
on the ground.
Yeah.
And that's really the hard part.
Wow. Well, thank you for tackling that. The whole big picture here and the work that you're doing and your group is doing to begin to get this out into the governments and into your own community in terms of education and just the big picture thinking.
We're trying.
Thank you. Thank you for
Thank
that.
You.
You're watching Peak Moment, Community Responses for a Changing Energy Future. I'm Janaea Donaldson. Join us next time.
Peak Moment Television. Presented by Yuba Gals Independent Media. Produced by Janaea Donaldson. Directed by Robin Maldren.